Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight into how it affects our national deterrence. We hope you enjoy this show.
Welcome back to another great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin and Jim Petrosky, who have been gone for a couple weeks, but now they're back. So it's the old team is back together.
We brought the band back together. It's so much fun.
And do you know why? The reason we brought the band back together is because we're on a mission from Gad.
Mission from Gad.
So, of course, the classic Blues Brothers. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've seen it at least half a dozen times. One of my favorite movies.
Once or twice.
So, never. At any rate, oh, you miss a great movie. It's a great movie. Both Blues Brothers movies are great. Okay, so for this week, Curtis was at the doctor office earlier this week or last week, and he said, I'm reading an article in Foreign Affairs that has just gotten me all hopped up. And he sent it to me, and I read it and thought, you know what, this would be a good point of discussion. Of course, I'm talking about Hal Brands, who wrote an article in Foreign Affairs that says, An America First World, What Trump's Return Might Mean for Global Order. And he's, of course, as if you've read his previous stuff, Hal Brands is, you know, pretty clearly a never-Trumper. And his article is, in some respects, it's critical of Trump's foreign policy, but it's a broader discussion of a foreign policy of restraint, which, you know, there's many on both Republican and Democrat sides that advocate for restraint. And, you know, an American foreign policy where we're less involved, where we're, you know, we don't get in the middle of every, you know, conflict, civil war, insurgency, etc., versus sort of internationalism, what used to be called prior to the, you know, the lackluster performance in Iraq and Afghanistan, what used to be called, you know, the neoconservatives. And it seems, you know, in Brands's article that he's very clearly advocating for sort of internationalism and opposing an ideology that would be more restraint and a more, you know, focused approach to foreign policy that seeks to do what's in the nation's best interest. And so he says, and I'll sort of open it up, he says on the first page, it's simply to ask what would happen if the country behaved in the same narrowly self-interested, frequently exploitative way as many great powers throughout history, if it rejected the idea that it has a special responsibility to shape a liberal order that benefits the wider world. And so that's sort of the stage setting. And then he defines, you know, the Trump foreign policy. He says the defining feature of Trump's worldview is his belief that the United States has no obligation to pursue anything larger than its own self-interest, narrowly construed. And then he goes on throughout the article to what I think, you know, just to try to be fair and balanced, is I don't think he accurately represents what Trump has advocated over the last 6 years. He sort of creates straw men and then, you know, burns them. But the broader point we wanted to discuss was to, you know, juxtapose these two schools of thought, you know, greater restraint versus, you know, internationalism. And so with that, Curtis, you're the one that brought the article up, and, you know, you were exercised by it. So let me turn it over to you first to get your reaction.
Well, thanks, Adam. It is good to see you. And Jim, it is good to see you. It's good to be back in the seat, so to speak, as we've been doing other things. And I also want to thank you for letting the audience know that even when I'm sitting in a doctor's office waiting on my wife to do her stuff in her appointments, I am still reading and learning and actively engaged in the world. I am not on my phone playing Angry Birds or Candy Crush. All right. So, yes, I found this article fascinating. I've met Hal Brands once. I've heard him speak a number of times. He is I'll use the term expert, authority on strategy, grand strategy, and sort of the thought processes of foreign policy. He's been in this world thinking and teaching.
Well,
and
I would say he's an academic.
He's an academic. I'm with you, and so to bring all that forward, you know, I wanted to appreciate out of this piece that this is we're really not talking about, you know, the Trump dynamic and the non-Trump dynamic. We'll call it, or kind of put it that way. What we really want to talk about here is this what I think is a false argument. That and I'll start right in here. You quoted an opening sentence, Adam, and I'll just add a quote another one. Is it fair? A little bit of a paraphrase here, but is it fair to ask what would happen if the United States retreated into outright isolationism? So, Dr. Brands really tries to proffer in this article that it is possible in the near future, depending upon how the election turns out, that America could proceed into an isolationism foreign policy, and that would be detrimental to world peace and security. And now we here at NIDS, we care a lot about, you know, nuclear deterrence and deterrence writ large, but it's all based on the idea of the peace and stability that it brings. So it makes sense for us to talk about peace and stability and some of these other mechanisms that, quite frankly, are underwritten by America's nuclear deterrent, which, to be fair, Hal Brands doesn't bring up at all in this piece. And I would argue this point, and I'm going to leave it be after this, is that whether you are an interventionist policy or an isolationist policy, the two ends of the spectrum or anything in between, you really are going to rely on a healthy, robust nuclear deterrent in order for you to do those things, right? If you're going to be all over the world kicking butt and taking names, you better have a strong nuclear capability to allow you to project all of that power. And enforcement, if you will, which Dr. Brands arguably says is something that we should be doing as America. If you're going to be an isolationist state where you retrench back home and you no longer engage in anything other than what threatens you in your homeland, you better have a large, strong, robust nuclear deterrent that has the capability of reaching and touching any potential adversary on the globe. And so no matter what all of however the world or America moves forward in the world after, after January 1st, 2025, it's still going to require a robust nuclear deterrent. So I'm going to put that out there and put that aside. But what I wanted to just note here before I hand it over to Jim, who I know is chomping to get started as well, is this idea here that if America takes on a sort of an America first, which I'm going to refer to as a non-interventionist foreign policy, that there's sort of this assumption that America first means America alone, and it does not. I think that is a false analogy. And again, to my listeners, I'm going to be full disclosure here. I am an anti-interventionist person as far as a mindset. It does not make me anti-ally or anti-global security or these sorts of things. I do disagree, Adam and Jim, with the spreading of democracy at the end of a bayonet. I think that is the wrong thing to do. But interventionists in the world, and especially those who come from the Hal Brands side of the argument, think that is okay. Because if there are more democracies and they are forced on the world by America, that somehow makes the world more secure and more prosperous. And I would argue that the issues that we see today in mid-2024. So I have a little calendar check here for whoever listens to this podcast a year from now, that the world is has enjoyed, quote unquote, 3.5 years of interventionist policies. And I would argue that the world is on fire. We've got, you know, we're in our third year in a war in Ukraine. We are in our third or fourth year of real aggressive saber rattling against Taiwan. We are in our eighth or ninth month of issues within the Middle East, whether it be Israel, Yemen, Iran, Syria, Iraq. The Middle East has not settled down since America left Afghanistan. And so there's a whole bunch of things going on. Venezuela is now threatening its neighbors. And so I would argue that interventionism has not helped peace and stability within the world. And I'm arguing that the premise of Dr. Brand's arguments here are really built in some sort of vision of what I think America's policies were maybe two decades ago.
Yeah, Jim, what was your take on the article?
Well, damn it, Adam, I'm a scientist, not a political scientist, okay?
So not a real scientist.
Oh, yeah, give me a break.
Here we go.
Right, here we go. But, you know, all this discussion about intervention and everything else, and on this subject, as you'd, you could ask my wife, I don't have a lot of background in this area, but I'm more than willing to give some opinions from reading it. So here we go. So,
well, that's what we're paid to do, right?
That's right. So that's where I come in here. So, so let me start out, first of all, and with all due respect to Dr. Hal Brands, I find these kinds of writings that are all or nothing relationships to discussions about things that happen, such as intervention. You know, if you're America first, then you know, to hell with everyone else. I don't see that as anyone standing anywhere, you know, Trump, Biden, you name them, you know, the same thing, you know, Biden's not, you know, hand everything to everybody and, you know, to hell with the United States. Oh, wait, I've used hell twice in a conversation here. You guys are probably just shocked. Okay. Oh, so anyway, yeah. So, but my point is that to me, that is somewhat of a lazy way of looking at life. It's all or nothing on both sides. And I don't see that as a good way to review the value of a policy or a strategy to others. So, you know, writ large, because the world is made up of different organizations with different interests, different self-interests, different country interests, different dynamics, etc. And that's why interventionism, Curtis, what is it?
Interventionism.
Interventionism. See, I told you I didn't know much about this, but it's okay. I'll keep rolling. So interventionism is a concern when your interests are different than the people you're intervening with, because now you run into the problem of having a conflict. For example, Dr. Hal Brands brings up Ukraine. Well, if I remember, there was a Budapest memorandum that both the Russians and Ukraine all said, we'll keep you from being attacked. That didn't go very well, did it? Because our interests were fairly different in all of these issues. So that's one. The second piece, and I'm going to turn this back to Curtis, and probably my primary interest coming out of this is the following. When it comes down to when it gets down to the nuclear part of this, and this is really important, when you're talking about nuclear nonproliferation, nuclear weapons development, nuclear strategies, that's all fine and good to be interacting with everyone else and build the treaties of protection, et cetera. But when we get to nuclear war and an existential threat, everyone, and I know there are agreements, but everyone will be in it for themselves first. It will be me first. I need to survive this. I understand, and I know there's probably political scientists out there that are just rolling over listening to me, but the reality is we have agreements, and we will stick by them, don't get me wrong, because they are in our interest. But when it comes to an existential threat, America first will be the policy. Every decision we make will be made in our interest. Curtis?
Jim, I want to thank you for playing along and describing the Budapest Memorandum as you did, because a lot of people think that the Budapest Memorandum is this idea that we would protect Ukraine. That's not in the Budapest Memorandum. It is about recognizing their sovereignty, right, and their right to exist. That's all that is about, right? And so this is right. This is sort of the essence of America First, is recognizing sovereignty, understanding that other countries have national interests, and figuring out how you can work with or around their national interests, because they're going to have them too, and they're not always going to align. And when they don't align, when your national interests don't align, that's when you have either at the least competition and at the most conflict. And so that's why we have foreign policy and diplomats and a military to negotiate those misalignments, essentially. And so it is important to understand, I think, a little bit of that difference and how you negotiate, the power that helps you to negotiate those misalignments and deal with those potential conflicts and extend the distance between competition and conflict is deterrence. That's what makes that gap bigger.
You know, one of the things that, as I was reading this, that struck me is to me it seems that what he is, the dichotomy that he creates is not one that is necessarily accurate. So, for example, this idea that, you know, we were altruistic, you know, from 1945 to, you know, the arrival of Donald Trump in the White House is one that I don't think is borne out by history. So, for example, when we undertook the Marshall Plan, that wasn't American altruism. That was to build a successful Western Europe to thwart the rise of, and the expansion of the Soviet Union.
Yep.
That was pure self-interest. And so this idea that where he says the version of the United States wouldn't be a global dropout on some issues, it might be more aggressive than before, but it would also be far less concerned with defending global norms, providing public goods, and protecting distant allies. I would say, it all depends. It depends on what is perceived as being America's interest.
That's correct.
And if you look at, he quotes Kennedy and he quotes others, and if you go back and look at some of their policies, it was Kennedy who left, you know, America's allies on the beaches of Cuba to be slaughtered as we listened to them on the radio, and they were begging for American air support. And he left them there because he didn't think it was in America's interest to continue with that invasion of Cuba. So, or when the United States left American allies, you know, the Hmong people who stood by us and fought, you know, the NVA, and then we left them to be slaughtered, you know, by the communist. America, regardless, I can give you examples of every one of, you know, Brand's sort of ideal presidents who acted in pure self-interest. And, you know, what is the great example? You know, we look to Joe Biden, and Joe Biden has been this guy who has gone out and defended Ukraine. And he said here recently that we will defend Taiwan. But it was Joe Biden who left Afghanistan in shambles and left 20 years of democracy building in complete ruins and in control of the Taliban again. So it's not only that all presidents act in pure self-interest, they all do, and interest changes over, you know, it's fluid, there's not really a good example of where interventionism has worked all that well. America's history of conflict post 1945 is a history of failure. That's why the army went back to the uniforms of World War II, because it was the last time they won a war.
Ouch.
Isn't that right, Jim?
Well, Adam, I thought you were going to take us all the way back to the Civil War and talk about the the war of northern aggression, but I'm glad you at least took us back to World War II. Anyway, the cav uniforms of the army as well. So anyway, but seriously, the thing that really concerns me about when I read articles like this, and I like reading controversial articles, so don't get me wrong, I think it's good for our audience to take a look at this article and read up on it and see what Absolutely. Points were made here. But I think that the piece that's important is that there are different ways of approaching different problems for different communities and different strategic outcomes. And you've got to be open to those with the interest of the country first, preserving peace in the world. Now you're saying, oh, that's coming second. You bet. The country first, peace in the world. They both are not mutually exclusive. In fact, peace around the world is a goal. It's a goal of our organization. It's a goal of much of our strategy to maintain peace, but with the interest of the United States in that. In other words, we can't just maintain peace by saying, well, whatever someone else wants, we'll just let them do it because that way we remain at peace. That doesn't happen very well. We have a constitution. We have an interest. We have a culture in America. We have a country that thrives because of its representative republic. It's it is developed in a way that maintains its structure as long as we keep it. So I know I'll put my flag back down, but truly that's what people don't understand. That's our interest. We want to maintain it.
So I would add to this, Dr. Brand's notes in this piece sort of throughout, it's sort of strung throughout this article, America may or may not always be there now under an America First policy. And to Adam's point, we will be there if it's in our national interest to be there, right? And I think that's an important thing. And I think the American people are now really thinking about, do I really want to continue to send sons and daughters to fight for other people's wars, endless wars, these sorts of ideas? Can we afford it anymore? Adam, we're approaching $35 trillion in debt, doing some quick math here, is $267,000 per taxpayer and $103,000 per citizen. This is real debt. And I don't know how we're going to be expected to pay that off if we're going to continue to intervene. Just to give you an idea, the debt to GDP ratio in 1980, arguably still the height of the Cold War, was 35%. In the year 2000, prior to 9/11, but after the Cold War, that GDP debt to ratio was 57%. So it's climbing. Today, that debt to GDP ratio is 122%. So it's more than doubled in the last 24 years. That's pretty significant. It makes the idea that we can afford to be everywhere and everything to everybody to be a bit maybe a bit too much to ask of the American taxpayer, who is already in debt at $267,000. I don't know about you. I think Jim's got that check to write, but Adam, you and I, we probably don't because we're not technical scientists, so we don't make as much money. But I would say that that this is an important key. And one of the issues here in the America First naysayers is that somehow America is not going to is going to disrespect its allies. And we've done podcasts on this already about NATO 2% and expecting our allies to sort of pay their fair share. These were complaints of President Obama. These were complaints of President Trump. And these continue to be complaints from President Biden. So I would say that this has spanned not only the political sides of the aisle, but also the interventionist and non-interventionist side of the aisle. So these are issues that remain and that we cannot necessarily ignore, but it does not mean that we will disengage. I think what really America First means is that it is beneficial that America engage when and where it must at the crucial points in order to make that right decision of whether or not to employ treasure and life. And the reality is that when you're not everywhere all the time, then when you do engage, your credibility is better.
Yeah, I'd say one more thing, Curtis, and you brought up the financial side of this, and that is that our relationship in the worldview is one that has to be dynamic. We can't always suggest that our answer is to just bring in the military and solve the problem or throw money into the problem. Sometimes we are in a position right now, and oh, by the way, regarding checks, I have at least 3 or 4 more checks in my checkbook, so tell me how big of a check to write. I can write a check any size you want, and he'll give it to you. Have a good time.
But you're going to dribble it all the way. Huh?
Yeah, you sure. But in all seriousness, though, you know, we are doing that right now. So the serious joke here is we are spending ahead of what we don't have. How good of a partner and how reliable of a partner to anybody in any place in the world can we be when we're writing checks that are written like I told you I'd write, that are based on something that's not there. Now, the economy is a whole other discussion we can have, but we have to change the dynamic way in which we view the strategy to meet the needs of now so yes. that we can rely on the future. Now I'm going to go to your favorite subject, Curtis, and that is with nuclear weapons, because they are the most efficient and effective way of developing a strategy where you can call the shots. And that's an important part of why the United States is asked to provide support. And so we've got to figure out how to make that strategy fit in there. And America first, if you're going to go all or nothing, you're going to say, I mean, it's just like I've heard somebody saying, well, next time we get into war, it's going to be nuclear. Well, that's just a dumb statement. I mean, it's just, it will. How can you predict that? And I've heard people say this, and you know, credible people say this, and you guys have too. We've talked about it, that people go to the all or nothing strategy, and yet we have diplomats, we have finance, we have economic ways of doing this, we have treaties, we have various ways in which the military can provide support conventionally long before we get to a nuclear war. But in the end, the most efficient, and you've talked about this before, the most efficient way to do this and maintain our economy is through maintaining that nuclear deterrent. So one, we don't go to war, because you go to war, you're going to spend a lot of money.
Much more expensive.
And number two, that we're going to lose lives. And number three, the things we want to help out with, and that is developing, you know, having countries develop and be able to handle themselves and be able to control their future, et cetera, that we'd like to see. If they want to do that, they're not going to be able to do that during war. They're just not.
He makes a point in the article where he says, growth exploded and living standards soared, first in the West and then globally, in the climate of security and economic cooperation that U.S. leadership fostered. War persisted, but great power war and outright territorial conquest became artifacts of an earlier, darker age.
Thank you, nuclear weapons.
Yeah, it wasn't. That's right. It wasn't U.S. leadership. It was that, you know, the Soviet Union and China and whoever else didn't want to get nuked. That's what it was. And you know, even in an America First world, nuclear weapons stay, and they actually we'll have more of them. We'll have a probably greater number and greater diversity. And you know, you mentioned, Curtis, you mentioned the cost. If you think about the war in Iraq, so we spent about $7 trillion Iraq.
Yeah, well, and the whole global war on terror. Yes,
the GWAT. So yeah. Iraq and Afghanistan were most of that. We have zero to show for it. That's zero. What interventionism does for you. Let's talk about the wars we've won since 1945. There are none. There are none. Let's, you know, because we were going to go in and promote stability and democracy, and it doesn't work. It's an abject failure, and I don't know what it takes to learn that. And then, of course, let's look at the U.S. economy. And, you know, you can't really say that the debt problem that we have now is, you know, fully the fault or the result of American expansionism or its desire to go out and, you know, install peace and democracy. Most of it is domestic programs. I mean, You know, if you look at what President Biden has done in his, 3 years in office, we're looking at $12 trillion in borrowing. We borrow it was $6 trillion within the first few months of taking office. That was all domestic spending that largely was, waste, fraud, and abuse lost. And then it's been $1 trillion every 100 days since. And so you can't maintain that, because today the servicing the national debt cost exactly the same as the entire defense budget. And it's not the defense budget that's growing, it's the servicing the debt that's growing much more rapidly. And so one of them's got to give. And then let's suppose hypothetically we balance the budget. Well, when you balance a budget and you actually have to constrain spending, and you can't just print money, because that's what we're printing money to borrow it. And the only person that it hurts is it hurts the lender, not the borrower. So the borrower is the United States government. And what it does is it reduces the value of debt. And so, you think about inflation. Well, who does inflation hurt? It doesn't hurt the government. It hurts we the people. And so, you're going to have to, if you're going to not hurt the American people more, you've got to constrain spending, you've got to stop printing money, and the natural way you have to do that is you have to constrain defense spending, i.e. all of the supplementals that we've had over the years to fund, many, many conflicts, and you've got to restrain domestic spending. And so therefore, you're going to find yourself in a position where you've got to just care about your interests, because that's the only way you stabilize the budget. And that's not a Republican or Democrat issue. That's a reality.
It's reality. It's just reality. Well, as we wrap things up here, I just want to kind of go over a couple of things that Hal says in this piece that I want to recommend our listeners read this piece. It's a great piece. It's well written. I disagree with much of it, but there are some nugget lessons in here, acknowledging that all countries pursue their interests, but not all countries define those interests in the same way. That truism could not be truer. And so pat on the back to Dr. Brands, and that the concept of national interest traditionally emphasized the protection of one's territory, population, wealth, and influence. Yes, that's what it is. And that's what I think those who pursue a non-interventionist policy want to do or keep more of, right? So he notes here, economically, an America First strategy would feature protectionism and predation, would seek to rebalance the burdens and benefits, and no more tolerating of asymmetric discrimination by trade partners. Yes, that's a good thing. But he presents that in this article as something wrong. We have been getting the dirty end of the stick from China and other trading blocs, and losing, countless amounts. The export import imbalance has been great. The Federal Trade Commission has estimated that we lose $600 billion in IP, intellectual property alone to China each year. These are tremendous amounts of issue. Hal notes that it would become more likely in an America First or non-interventionist strategy that we would cut transactional deals with undemocratic regimes. Gee, we've never done that before, right? I think I recall in the Reagan era, when talking about Ferdinand Marcos, Reagan said, he may be a dictator, but he's our dictator. So we've done this before. And that we would de-emphasize international law and international organizations. I'm not sure about de-emphasizing international law, but I'm not a big fan of the United Nations. I haven't seen it do a lot of good. In fact, there's some accusations about missteps when handling COVID-19 pandemic. There's missteps with the folks in Gaza handling issues in, with the Israeli wars and things like that. Yes, and we seem to be perfectly comfortable. The interventionists and global traders seem to be perfectly fine trading with countries like China with, with accusations of slave labor and child labor and these sorts of things. And the Africa mines for cobalt, of child mining and these sorts of things. These things are sort of overlooked by the interventionists who seem to find benefit in much of that. Advocates of restraint may hope that America retrenchment will compel like-minded countries to step forward. But today, as Russia and China churn out arms and too many European and Asian democracies struggle to field minimally capable militaries, it seems safer to bet that a vacuum created by American retrenchment would be filled by the world's most aggressive states. Or those democracy-leaning economies will actually invest in their military, value their own sovereignty and democratic way of life, and defend themselves, and not in isolation from the United States, in coordination and partnership, but not a sole dependency on. We should not be the sole guard dog for allies out there. We should respect them more. And I would argue, and we've had this conversation before, we seem to work very hard to make sure that responsible first world allies who are even just asking the question about acquiring their own nuclear weapons to meet their own security needs, we work very hard to ensure that they won't do that. And it's not because that is beneficial to the U.S. with regard to not providing enough security. Having a nuclear-armed Korea, for example, I think would definitely add to the security question. It is about the politics of non-proliferation and nuclear disarmament that forces us to place economic burdens on allies, or threats of economic burdens on allies, so that they won't do something that's counter to our own or certain interventionists who want to have these politically expedient policies of non-proliferation. So I would argue that much of what Dr. Brand says can be counter-argued in a very reasonable sense. And I challenge all of our listeners to do that.
Now, before we bring this show to an end, Jim, Curtis offered a lot of food for thought in his monologue, but was there something that you wanted to sort of wrap us up with?
Well, yeah, I'll wrap it up with a shot to both you and Curtis. To Curtis, you ask our readers to read the article, but after that monologue, I guess they don't have to. In all seriousness, I do think that it's important that you read things you agree or disagree with and talk with others and find out what they think. I think that's one thing we've lost in our American discourse that makes us strong. Read things, listen to things, discuss them, find out what other people think. You'll learn something. I certainly learn every time I'm on this podcast. I learn from Curtis and Adam. And so it's valuable for me. As I said up front, I am the poster child for if you don't know something, that's okay. You still have an opinion and be fair to share it. And then the last thing is regarding not knowing anything. If you don't think you can get away with not knowing something, listen to some of Adam's scientific discussions. And, you know, he's a science, but hey, some other kind of scientist. So I gave my parting shot to Adam. So there you go.
Albert Einstein was asked about the physics of nuclear weapons, and he said, "The physics are easy, the strategy is hard."
I think he said, "Understand the science, the math will come later." But that's okay.
I like Adam's quote world better.
So as we wrap it up, let me just recommend to our listeners. If you go to www.usdebtclock.org, you really get a good sense of what the debt is and just how fast it's growing. And you get a lot of other really interesting and useful data there. So check out that website, check out the article. And of course, thanks for listening. And as always, we want to remind you to think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.